Since 1996, Saudi national Omar al-Bayoumi and his family had lived in Claremont, California, a suburb of San Diego. A popular man among San Diego's Muslim community, al-Bayoumi spent much of his time at the mosques. He took pride in helping Muslim immigrants become established in America.
As one friend would later say, al-Bayoumi, quote, knew everyone. If he vouched for some people, they would be accepted.
At the end of January 2000, al-Bayoumi traveled to Los Angeles. While having lunch at a Middle Eastern restaurant near LAX, he overheard a couple of men speaking in Arabic. Ever the hospitable host, al-Bayoumi suggested the two men come to San Diego so he could introduce them to the Saudi community. He even offered to help them find housing and to front them rent money until they found work.
The grateful newcomers introduced themselves as Khalid al-Midhar and Nawaf al-Hazmi. 18 months later, they would be among the hijackers who took control of American Airlines Flight 77, which crashed into the Pentagon.
As for Omar al-Bayoumi, further investigation into his background led to the possibility that he may have been a Saudi spy.
This has caused many to speculate, did Saudi Arabia help finance the attacks on September 11th?
Welcome to Conspiracy Theories, a Spotify original from Parcast. Every Monday and Wednesday, we dig into the complicated stories behind the world's most controversial events and search for the truth. I'm Carter Roy.
And I'm Molly Brandenburg.
And neither of us are conspiracy theorists.
But we are open-minded, skeptical, and curious. Don't get us wrong. Sometimes the official version is the truth.
But sometimes it's not.
You can find episodes of Conspiracy Theories and all other Spotify originals from Parcast for free on Spotify.
Normally, we take things story by story, conspiracy by conspiracy. But in honor of the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks, we're doing something a little different.
Over the past three episodes, we've unpacked the official story behind 9/11. We charted the rise of Osama bin Laden and the fatwa that led to the surprise attacks in New York and Washington. We also dissected and debunked the more outlandish conspiracy theories that have since been linked to that tragic day.
Today, we're focusing on the Carlyle Group, a private equity firm that benefited financially in the wake of the attacks. We'll discuss Carlyle's origins and its connection to three powerful families: the Saudi royals, the Bushes, and the bin Ladens.
And we'll dive into the Bush administration's attempt to cover up even deeper ties between the three families.
We'll dive into the seedy world of the Carlyle Group right after this. This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. Bottling everything up can be really bad for you in the long run and have some terrible consequences, and this isn't a conspiracy theory. The more you let things build up, the more of a toll it can take on your mental health. I know for me, in dealing with some traumatic events in my life, I had the tendency to think, well, they've already happened, I'm okay, other people have it worse, it doesn't matter much. And through therapy, I was really able to understand how those events impacted me and changed how I'd started to see the world in ways that weren't great and were sometimes making my life worse. So therapy or dealing with any traumatic events you've had might really help you in terms of how you can live in the present moment now. So if you want to give therapy a try, check out BetterHelp. It's entirely online, convenient, and flexible. It's also really easy to get started. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/conspiracy today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/conspiracy. This episode is brought to you by Terminix. There's one thing we can all agree on: dealing with pests is a pain. But luckily, Terminix can help. because when pests show up, so does Terminix. With over 95 years of experience, they have what it takes to take on any pest problem fast. So if your home or business has pests, don't stress it. Terminix it. Visit Terminix.com to book your appointment online today. That's TERMINIX.com.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
In the years after September 11th, many Americans found it hard to believe that the official story was the whole truth. It seemed inconceivable that a small band of terrorists could pull off such a massive surprise attack.
Some wondered if the whole tragedy was an inside job by the Bush administration, or part of a global conspiracy to institute a new world order. After all, there's proof that a select few profited off the tragedy. But the fact that the beneficiary was a private equity firm was beyond comprehension for many. And one firm with links to both President Bush and Osama bin Laden cashed in big.
The Carlyle Group was founded on a flaw in the system. In the mid-1980s, a couple of Washington insiders and businessmen discovered a tax loophole involving Alaskan corporations.
By that time, the major industrial boom in Alaska had come and gone. So in 1984, a tax bill was passed to give failing Alaskan companies some relief. Under the new law, any company could buy up the losses of an Alaskan-owned company, earning themselves a massive tax write-off.
Essentially, the buyers were bailing out Alaskan companies and saving millions on their taxes in the process.
When the Carlyle Group founders learned about this loophole, they began negotiating deals between failing Alaskan companies and prospective buyers. And all they took was a 1% transaction fee.
The Carlyle Group officially formed in 1987, and the stage was set for them to strike a long-term bonanza. Unfortunately, many of the Alaskan companies immediately overstated their losses, which, of course, drew the eyes of Uncle Sam.
After an IRS investigation revealed that companies were misreporting the numbers, the government ended the tax relief in 1988.
But for the nascent Carlyle Group, expansion was the only way forward. In September 1988, the group hired Washington insider Frederick V. Malek as a consultant.
Malek got his start in Washington working for Richard Nixon as a special advisor and eventually became deputy chairman of the Republican National Committee. Earlier that year, he resigned after a story broke that he'd played a role in demoting Jewish employees within Nixon's administration.
However, for the Carlyle Group, Malek's political Rolodex compensated for his scandalous past. And one of the earliest names Malek brought into the Carlyle sphere was George W. Bush.
In July 1989, the Carlyle Group acquired the Marriott Hotels airline catering service. The new company was called Cater Air, and Malek became co-chairman.
Prior to being ousted from the RNC, Malek had met George W. Bush during his father's campaign. And Malek thought his old friend was the perfect candidate to join the Cater Air board of directors.
The idea was a win-win for everybody. Malek had direct access to the new president, Bush Sr., and George W. had a distinguished position on his resume.
George W. joined Cater Air in February 1990, though his time there didn't really amount to much in the way of actual work. According to one board member, he wasn't, quote, really engaged in Cater Air's business. Rather, the younger Bush was only there to help with airline regulation issues as it pertained to a different Carlyle company, Northwest Airlines.
In other words, George W. was just a pipeline to his father, the president. A useful pipeline not just for airline regulation, but possibly for the Carlyle Group's other holdings, which included weapons and defense companies.
The aftermath of the Alaskan tax scheme left the Carlyle Group at a tipping point. Cater Air and Northwest Airlines pointed them toward aviation, but they also dabbled in real estate. And across the board, a lot of their deals went bust. They needed an avenue that could provide them with a sure thing.
Enter Vice Chairman Frank Carlucci, college roommate to one Donald Rumsfeld.
Carlucci joined Carlyle in 1989, thanks, of course, to Fred Malik. Prior to that, Carlucci had spent 30 years climbing his way through the government bureaucracy, eventually becoming Ronald Reagan's Secretary of Defense.
Defense and intelligence were Carlucci's bread and butter. And similar to how the Bushes provided political opportunities, Carlucci provided a bounty of contacts within the weapons and defense industries.
In September 1990, 7 months after George W. Bush became a board member of Cater Air, Carlucci helped the Carlyle Group acquire a company called Braddock Dunn McDonald, or BDM.
At the time, BDM was, as journalist Dan Briety put it, quote, one of the most successful defense consulting companies in the history of the industry.
With Carlucci leading the charge, Carlyle had finally found its niche. 2 years later, the group teamed up with Loral Corp and Northrop to purchase the Defense and Aerospace Division of LTV.
Northrop would eventually become Northrop Grumman, one of the world's largest weapons manufacturers.
And in 1997, Carlyle made its most significant acquisition when it bought United Defense. The company had risen to prominence for creating the Bradley, an armored vehicle used during the Gulf War. As the new millennium approached, United Defense was looking to put its latest toys in action.
By the mid to late 1990s, business was booming for Carlyle. The group had the spare cash to lobby Washington and to expand its interests throughout Europe and the Middle East.
Meanwhile, George W. Bush left Cater Air when he announced that he was running for governor of Texas in 1994. But that wasn't the end of the Carlyle Group's Washington pipeline.
In fact, the group's coterie of consultants included former Secretary of State James Baker III, future Secretary of State Colin Powell, and the now former President George H.W. Bush himself.
Supposedly, George H.W. Bush's association with Carlyle was merely a publicity ploy to pack conferences and draw in potential investors. However, the true nature of his involvement remains controversial.
Throughout the late 1990s, Bush Sr. made trips throughout the Middle East, notably Saudi Arabia, and to South Korea.
South Korea was particularly notable at that time because President Clinton was in the midst of a diplomatic arms discussion with North Korea.
When George W. Bush became president in 2001, one of the first things he did was put an end to those diplomatic discussions. Tensions quickly rose between the U.S. and North Korea. This left critics to wonder if the father was dictating the son's actions. Should the U.S. and North Korea come to blows, it isn't hard to see who would benefit. Those with investments in defense contracts.
Naturally, there was an uproar over the perceived conflict of interest regarding the former president's business dealings, especially when, a few months later, the New York Times broke another story about Bush Sr.'s unofficial duties.
From the start, the new Bush administration was noticeably friendly toward Israel, which put them in conflict with various Arab countries. Among the more vocal critics of the new Bush White House was Saudi Arabia.
According to the New York Times, Bush Sr. took it upon himself to smooth things over. He personally called Crown Prince Abdullah and assured him that his son's heart was in the right place and that he would, quote, do the right thing.
Some foreign policy advisors claimed that Bush Sr. was simply trying to bridge the gap, given George W.'s lack of foreign policy experience.
Bush Sr. already had a good relationship with the Saudis since they'd allowed U.S. troops to station in the kingdom during the Gulf War. It was obvious that he was just doing diplomatic damage control.
But others believed what Bush Sr. was really doing was easing the fears of his business partners. After all, two of the biggest global investors in the Carlyle Group were none other than the Saudi royal family and the Bin Ladens.
Coming up, the Saudi royal family and the Bin Ladens make a fortune in the desert.
The most urgent mysteries in the world are missing persons cases. The stakes are too high not to pursue every plausible possibility, and some implausible ones too. I'm Sarah Turney, host of the new podcast, Disappearances. In 2020, after spending years searching for the truth, I used social media to help bring justice to my sister Alyssa's nearly two decades long disappearance. Now, every Thursday on Spotify, I'm exploring the many reasons people disappear and the impact their absences can have on those left behind. From child abductions and mystifying murders, to those who took drastic measures to start over, each episode of Disappearances journeys through a different high-profile missing persons case, ripped from the headlines and ripe for explanation. Because no one just vanishes into thin air. The answers are out there, waiting to be found. Follow the Spotify original from Parcast, Disappearances. Hear a new episode every Thursday, free and only on Spotify.
This episode is brought to you by Terminix. Terminix can't help you solve the world's biggest mysteries or take on alien life, at least not the ones you're thinking of, but they can help take care of pesky invaders in your home, like the ants in your kitchen, the roaches under your sink, and the termites in the walls. Because when pests show up, so does Terminix. No matter what type of bug it is, they can Terminix it fast with personalized pest care that puts you in control. And with over 95 years of experience, it's no wonder they're trusted by homes and businesses everywhere. So if you have a pest problem, don't stress it. Terminix it. Visit Terminix.com to book your appointment online today. That's TERMINIX.com.
Now, back to the story.
Throughout the 1990s, the Carlyle Group struck gold, thanks to contacts with former government personnel, including George Bush Sr. and Jr. The group was able to corner the market on defense.
But Carlyle wasn't exclusively for Americans. As they were building their defense empire, they looked beyond U.S. borders to two of the richest families in the world. Their foreign investors included the House of Saud and the Bin Ladens.
Saudi Arabia was once an undeveloped nation with no infrastructure, until March 1938, when oil was discovered in the kingdom. Thus began one of the biggest oil booms in world history. And almost all of the money went directly to the Saudi royal family.
With all of this money flowing, the time had finally come to build up the kingdom. Initially, public projects like schools, roads, and hospitals were commissioned by the Arabian American Oil Company, or Aramco, a subsidiary of an American company known today as Chevron.
Eventually, though, the Saudi government turned more responsibility over to locals. Among them was an Aramco bricklayer named Muhammad bin Awad bin Laden, the father of Osama bin Laden.
Muhammad bin Laden was born in Yemen, but made his way into Saudi Arabia in 1931. Eventually, he landed a job working for Aramco and earned a glowing reputation within the company.
Despite being illiterate, Muhammad was mathematically and architecturally intelligent. He essentially had a photographic memory when it came to measurements and calculations. This made him a perfect candidate for a new company program.
According to journalist Lawrence Wright, quote, Aramco began a program that granted employees a leave for a year in order to try their luck in business. If they failed, they could return to the company with no loss in status.
Mohammed bin Laden did just that. While working in the city of Jeddah, the Minister of Finance noted the quality of his work and vouched for him to the king. The king was impressed, and before long, he made bin Laden honorary Minister of Public Works.
It would be hyperbolic to say that Mohammed bin Laden single-handedly built Saudi Arabia. And yet, the vast majority of important public projects were tied back to him, including renovating the two holiest places in the kingdom, the Prophet's Mosque and the Grand Mosque.
As bin Laden's success grew and the wealth poured in, he made sure to stay in the royal family's good graces.
Despite the profits from the oil boom, Saudi Arabia's credit was inadequate and there was no money in the treasury. When King Faisal went searching for a foreign loan, he was turned down. Instead, Mohammed bin Laden bailed him out.
This sealed the relationship between the bin Ladens and the House of Saud.
At the time Mohammed bin Laden died in 1967, it's believed that he was worth $5 billion. Allegedly, Osama bin Laden, his 17th child out of over 50, inherited between $25 and $30 million.
The death of the patriarch did nothing to sever the ties between the bin Ladens and the House of Saud. In fact, when Osama started lobbying the government for funds during the Afghan-Soviet war, the crown prince gave him between $350 and $500 million a year.
Heading into the 1990s, both families were some of the richest in the world. And like nearly all wealthy families, they looked toward diversifying their portfolio. They found the perfect partners with the Carlyle Group.
In the early 1990s, Citicorp, known today as Citigroup, was in financial turmoil. They needed cash quickly. Luckily, Prince Al-Walid bin Talal Al-Saud, nephew to the King of Saudi Arabia, offered a hand.
In 1991, the Saudi prince purchased almost $600 million worth of the company's stock, making him one of the largest shareholders of Citicorp. And the Carlyle Group brokered the deal.
Carlyle didn't receive a major fee from the deal. However, what they got in return was something even better: access to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
The Citicorp deal gave Carlyle a boost in terms of global recognition. The timing was perfect, since it coincided with Vice Chairman Frank Carlucci's effort to steer the company toward defense contractors.
In fact, after the Citicorp deal, Carlyle bought BDM, that major defense consulting firm. Carlyle then used their BDM and its Saudi connections to buy a mysterious military and construction company called Vinel Corp.
In 1975, Vinel had signed a $77 million deal to train the Saudi Arabian National Guard, the royal family's personal security. In 1992, it became part of the growing Carlyle portfolio, which, as we mentioned earlier, soon included United Defense.
By the mid-1990s, the Carlyle Group was a major influence in Saudi Arabia. They'd attracted the attention of some of the kingdom's wealthiest families, including the bin Ladens.
The earliest connection between the bin Laden family and the Carlyle Group came sometime in the early 1990s, when both sides came together in an unsuccessful attempt to buy Italian petroleum. By 1994, the bin Ladens invested $2 million into a Carlyle buyout fund called Carlyle Partners II.
Considering the figures we've been discussing, $2 million doesn't seem like a lot. However, there is speculation that the bin Ladens invested even more into the fund than what was reported. Both a family representative and a Carlyle representative have gone on record saying the $2 million figure is way too low.
Regardless, The fact remains that the Bin Ladens were financially tied to the Carlyle Group, and in turn, with the House of Saud and the Bushes.
But this wasn't the first time these three powerful families had shared business interests. Rather, it was like old friends coming together again.
The relationship between these three families was always nebulous. Some of it was direct, and some of it was indirect. But all of it was connected by two men, James Baker III and James R. Bath.
Long before joining Carlyle, James Baker III was close friends and business partners with George H.W. Bush. Hailing from a powerful Texas family, Baker lived up to the family name by earning a reputation as a tough Houston attorney.
During the 1950s, Bush Sr. and Baker became friends while playing tennis at the Houston Country Club. Soon, Baker's family's law firm would become the go-to for Bush's oil business, Zapata Petroleum.
Now, Baker himself wasn't allowed to work at the family business because the firm had an anti-nepotism rule. But when Bush decided to enter politics, Baker was at his side helping with the campaigns. Eventually, Baker would become chief of staff to Reagan and Bush Sr., and later Bush Sr.'s Secretary of State.
While H.W. Bush was slowly climbing up the political ladder, the Saudis were slowly making their presence known in Texas. Throughout the 1970s, Saudi investors began pouring money into Texas companies of all kinds: oil, parts manufacturing, banks, even public works.
These investments may not be as random as they seem. In the late 1970s, Khalid bin Mahfouz, a Saudi banker, invested in the construction of the Texas Commerce Tower, known today as the J.P. Morgan Chase Tower. One of bin Mahfouz's investment partners was Texas Commerce Bank. And who owned over 110,000 shares of Texas Commerce? James Baker III.
Journalist Craig Unger notes that when Baker became Reagan's chief of staff in 1981, he put his stock in a blind trust, a common practice when entering public service. However, he still served as a personal link between Saudi investors and the White House.
And in fact, not long after Reagan took office, one of his first acts was to sell 5 aircraft radar systems to the Saudis, with Vice President Bush lobbying for it.
Throughout the 1980s and into the 1990s, the relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia increased dramatically. They were partners in funding the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, and then partners in fighting the Gulf War against Saddam Hussein. And on the American side, much of the relationship came through Baker and George H.W. Bush.
But Baker wasn't the only Texan helping Saudis make inroads with the Bushes. James R. Bath was a businessman who befriended George W. Bush while they both served in the Texas Air National Guard in the 1970s. After his service, Bath got a job working for an aviation company that brokered airplanes. And in 1974, he sold an airplane to Salem bin Laden, Osama's eldest brother.
Before long, Bath became friends with Salem bin Laden and other Saudi businessmen, including Khalid bin Mahfouz.
This is the same bin Mahfouz who invested in the Texas Commerce Tower.
Within 2 years, Bath became Salem and bin Mahfouz's American representative, helping them invest in various ways. As Bath told journalist Craig Unger, quote, "The investments were sometimes in my name as trustee, sometimes offshore corporations, and sometimes in the name of the law firm."
One of the investments Bath made was in a small Texas oil company called Arbisto Energy, George W. Bush's first energy firm. Allegedly, the $50,000 that Bath invested actually came from Salem bin Laden and another prominent Saudi businessman.
Though this money trail has been disputed, tax records indicate that Bath did invest in Arbisto. And, as Time magazine notes, he was a stockholder until Bush eventually sold the firm to Harkin Energy in the mid-1980s.
Disputed paper trails are a common theme when it comes to the relationship between the Bushes, the Saudis, and the Bin Ladens. But the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. As the next part of this story suggests, these three families had incredible power to cover their tracks, or to cover each other's tracks when need be.
After September 11th, the U.S. House of Representatives and Senate jointly investigated the attacks. When their report was published in 2003, the Bush administration redacted 28 consecutive pages.
According to Senate Intelligence Committee Chairman Bob Graham, those 28 pages all concern the hijackers' connections to Saudi Arabia.
Coming up, 28 redacted pages may give key insight into 9/11.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
Now, back to the story.
15 of the 19 9/11 hijackers were Saudi nationals. Osama bin Laden was a Saudi national. The Saudi government was known to support the Mujahideen during the Soviet-Afghan War because Osama bin Laden lobbied them for help. And yet, Saudi Arabia is rarely mentioned in the same breath as September 11th, which has led some people to wonder if that's by design.
When the 9/11 Commission report was published in the summer of 2004, it did not accuse the Saudi government of financing the attacks. However, it also didn't exactly absolve them of financing terrorism in general.
The report states, quote, "Saudi Arabia has long been considered the primary source of al-Qaeda funding, but we have found no evidence that the Saudi government as an institution or senior Saudi officials individually funded the organization. This conclusion does not exclude the likelihood that charities with significant Saudi government sponsorship diverted funds to al-Qaeda."
But according to former counterterrorism official Richard A. Clark, regardless of whether the Saudi government personally funded al-Qaeda, they may have provided cover for the terrorists.
In his book, Against All Enemies, Clark writes, quote, "For several years prior to September 11th, United States government provided the Saudis with information about al-Qaeda members in the kingdom. That information seemed to disappear into a black hole. Seldom were we told the results, if any, of investigations into the information we provided."
If what Clark alleges is true, it seems strange that the White House didn't look more closely into Saudi Arabia, especially after the commission report suggested that Saudi charities might have funded 9/11.
Or perhaps they did look more closely, and George W. Bush didn't like what was found.
As we mentioned before, the famous 9/11 commission wasn't the only investigation into the September 11th attacks. A separate joint inquiry by the House and Senate Intelligence Committees began in early 2002.
Led by Senator Bob Graham, the investigation limited itself strictly to intelligence matters. The questions at hand were, how did the American intelligence community fail to prevent 9/11 in the first place, and what could be done to stop it from happening again?
By the end of 2002, the joint inquiry filed their classified report. For 7 months, they waited for the report to come back with redactions from the CIA, FBI, NSA, and White House before releasing it to the public.
As expected, many of the pages contained redactions, which isn't unusual for matters of national security. However, among the redactions was an entire section, 28 continuous pages. And according to Senator Graham, those pages linked some of the 9/11 hijackers to the Saudi government.
Graham writes about some of these connections in his 2004 book, Intelligence Matters. According to Graham, at the beginning of 2000, two of the 9/11 hijackers, Khalid al-Midhar and Nawaf al-Hazmi, arrived in Los Angeles from Asia. Although they traveled throughout the U.S., San Diego became their hub until the attacks.
According to the 9/11 Commission report, both al-Midhar and al-Hazmi were, quote, ill-prepared for a mission in the United States. Neither of them had ever really spent much time in the West, and neither spoke much English. Therefore, the report notes, it's very likely that both men had a contact to help them.
According to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the man who brought the idea of airplane attacks to bin Laden, no other al-Qaeda members were in San Diego at the time. Instead, al-Midhar and al-Hazmi were instructed to make connections in California through the local mosques.
And while they did receive help from San Diego mosques, it appears they may have also had help from an alleged Saudi spy named Omar al-Bayoumi.
Al-Bayoumi had been living in San Diego since 1996. His mission was to monitor Saudi students in the area and report any anti-Saudi government activities.
At the end of January 2000, he drove up to Los Angeles for a meeting at the Saudi consulate. After the meeting, he went to a Middle Eastern restaurant where he serendipitously met two recent arrivals. Their names were Khalid al-Midhar and Nawaf al-Hazmi.
Al-Bayoumi invited them to San Diego and promised to help them get established. The two future hijackers accepted the offer, and about a week later, they moved to San Diego. Once there, Al-Bayoumi helped them with housing, gave them financial support, and introduced them to the San Diego Saudi community.
Al-Bayoumi never disclosed where his money came from. According to Senator Graham, it simply came from a, quote, unidentified source at home.
But during the joint inquiry, investigators discovered two money trails that seemed a little odd. The first regarded Al-Bayoumi's cover story.
While in San Diego, Al-Bayoumi worked for a company called Urcan. Interestingly, Urcan had contacts with an aviation company owned by Salah Kamel, a wealthy Saudi who, according to Graham, regularly donated to Al-Qaeda.
Al-Bayoumi's job was what's known as a no-show gig, like a mobster working in construction. He was just on the payroll so that he could focus on monitoring student dissidents. When supervisors complained that Al-Bayoumi never came to work, the Saudi government threatened to pull the contract if they fired him.
Prior to 2000, Al-Bayoumi's monthly salary was $2,800, with $465 allowed in expenses. But in March 2000, a month after al-Midhar and al-Hazmi moved to San Diego, the allowance suddenly jumped from $465 to $3,700, more than his salary itself. It didn't seem impossible that a known Saudi spy was using back channels like Urcan to help finance 9/11.
Nor is this the only possible money trail. As it turns out, Al-Bayoumi wasn't the only supposed Saudi spy in San Diego. Another man named Osama Basnan was allegedly being groomed as his replacement.
Investigators discovered that in April 1998, Basnan's wife needed thyroid surgery and appealed to the Saudi Royal Embassy for help. Apparently, the royal family often financially assists Saudis abroad.
Ultimately, the Basnans received a check for $15,000, but it wasn't enough. So, Basnan's wife pleaded with the ambassador's wife, Princess Haifa al-Faisal.
Princess Haifa was the daughter of the long-since-deceased King Faisal, the same king who was financially bailed out by Osama bin Laden's father.
The princess agreed to help the Basnans, and beginning in January 1999, they received checks of up to $3,000 a month. But a year later, something strange happened. According to Senator Graham, quote, beginning in 2000, Basnan's wife began signing her checks over to a woman named Manal Bajader, the wife of Omar al-Bayoumi.
No explanation was ever given, but it appears as if Omar al-Bayoumi, an alleged Saudi spy, was using his no-show government contracted job and the wife of another alleged Saudi spy to funnel cash into the hands of two 9/11 hijackers.
When the joint inquiry report came back with these 28 pages redacted, Senator Graham wasn't surprised, though still disappointed. He asked President Bush to release the pages, but Bush refused.
What troubled Graham the most was that, in his estimation, the 28 pages didn't actually accuse the Saudis of directly funding 9/11. It simply called for further investigation into the matter.
But further investigation might uncover the deep ties between the Bushes, the Saudis, and the Carlyle Group.
After all, in the wake of 9/11, the Carlyle Group saw a windfall of cash come their way. Their subsidiary, United Defense, received a $665 million government contract.
In December 2001, Carlyle took United Defense public, making a profit of $237 million in a single day. And when Carlyle finally sold United Defense in 2004, it ultimately made $1 billion from its total investment.
The effort to steer Carlyle toward defense had finally paid off. Everyone made millions, except the bin Ladens, who were forced out of Carlyle before the contracts came in to save face.
It's possible that the House of Saud, as well as other Saudi businessmen, were also on the receiving end of the Carlyle windfall. Ultimately, though, we may never know the specifics.
Just like we may never know the full extent of Saudi Arabia's role in 9/11. In 2007, the FBI launched an operation to dig deeper into the connection. Unfortunately, a lack of hard evidence and the nascent threat of ISIS shuttered the operation in 2016.
That same year, Barack Obama declassified the 28 pages that Bush had redacted from the Joint Inquiry Report. The public saw that Bob Graham was correct in his assessment. No direct links between the Saudi government and 9/11, but further investigation into the relationship was recommended.
Yet before anyone could even consider pointing the spotlight on the kingdom, it was as if George W. Bush had unplugged the light. Instead, he distracted the American people with a different enemy, albeit a familiar one.
In 2003, the U.S. invaded Iraq, and in the months leading up to the invasion, the Bush administration tried to sell the public on the notion that Iraq was actually the country that helped al-Qaeda commit the 9/11 attacks.
Some supported the invasion, others despised it, and many began to wonder if Bush was exploiting the tragedy of 9/11 to further his own agenda. Or worse, if he'd played a part in the tragedy from the very beginning. Thanks for tuning in to Conspiracy Theories. In our next episode, we'll explore how the Bush administration used 9/11 as an excuse to invade Iraq. We'll also try to answer major questions like, how much did Bush know, and when did he know it?
Until then, remember, the truth isn't always the best story.
And the official story isn't always the truth.
Conspiracy Theories is a Spotify original from Parcast. Executive producers include Max and Ron Cutler. Sound design by Russell Nash, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Trent Williamson, Carly Madden, and Bruce Katovich. This episode of Conspiracy Theories was written by Joe Guerra, with writing assistance by Kate Gallagher and Mackenzie Moore. Fact-checking by Cara Mackerlane, and research by Bradley Klein. Conspiracy Theories stars Molly Brandenburg and Carter Roy.
I'm Sarah Turney, host of the new Spotify original from Parcast, Disappearances. Every Thursday, join me for an exploration into history's most gripping missing persons cases. Following timelines, analyzing clues, and piecing together as many answers as possible to find the truth. From prison breaks and child abductions to second chances and even murder, we'll journey through the many reasons people disappear. Follow my new podcast, Disappearances, free and only on Spotify.